Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the seventh season of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion's Continuing Learning Series, Alumni Learn. This is, as always, a special project of our president, Rabbi Aaron Pankin. I'm Dina Stein, Assistant Director of Alumni Engagement and Development and Director of Alumni Learn. During this session and throughout the year, you can always reach alumni engagement at alumni@hoc.edu. I'll share with you some technical details about this session in a moment. We at HUCJIR are excited to bring you the latest in research and learning from our fantastic faculty. This year, we are pleased to offer online opportunities for learning focused on engaging learners with Israel, Beyond the Pew, Modern Jewish Ethics, special sessions, and mini courses taught by our most well-known faculty. I do also want to point out that we recently added a new mini course. So I do encourage you to go to huc.edu/alumnilearn to take a look at that course as well. Today we are honored to present a session from our series Modern Jewish Ethics with Rabbi Rachel Adler, PhD, Rethinking Gender. I will introduce her momentarily. Before I do that though, I would like to say a few words about Alumni Learn. Any associated materials or recommended reading from this session will be posted on the ancillary materials page of the Alumni Learn site, huc.edu/alumnilearn. And to those who are joining live today, I did email you out the documents. If you do need them during the session, please send me an email, again, alumni@huc.edu, and I will be happy to send those once again to you. Shortly, you will receive a link for an evaluation of today's learning. You will also find this link posted with the recorded sessions and ancillary materials. Please take a few moments to fill out this brief evaluation, as your feedback does assist us in providing future learning that we hope meets your interests and needs. If you wish to provide further comment, please email me at alumni@huc.edu. You are encouraged to ask questions to today's speaker. If you are joining the session online, you can either add your questions in the chat box, which you can open by moving your mouse on the Zoom screen and clicking the chat button at the bottom. You will also have the opportunity to unmute your audio, but again, we do ask you to mute your audio when you are not speaking so that we can cut down on background noise for our recording. And as we get to those points, I will explain to you how we can do that, how you can unmute yourself if you do not know. You can also, if you are on the phone, email me alumni@huc.edu and I will be happy to read your questions for you, time permitting. If you have technical difficulties with today's session, write in the chat box or email desupport@huc.edu and our team will be happy to assist you. Now, it is my great pleasure to welcome today's speaker. Rachel Adler is the Rabbi David Ellenson Professor of Jewish Religious Thought and Professor of Modern Jewish Thought and Feminist Studies at HUCJIR in Los Angeles. Before I continue, I apologize. Carly, if you could please mute whoever just joined, that would be appreciated.
Yep, I'm working on it.
Okay. She was one of the first theologians to integrate feminist perspectives and concerns into the interpretation of Jewish texts and the renewal of Jewish law and ethics. Her essay, The Jew Who Wasn't There, first published in 1971, is generally considered the first piece of Jewish feminist theology. She is the author of Engendering Judaism, which won the National Jewish Book Award for Jewish Thought. She is the first female theologian to win this award. Engendering Judaism is also available in a Hebrew translation as Feminism Yehudi, Theologia Umusav. Adler's academic credentials include a PhD in religion and social ethics from the University of Southern California with a conjoint certificate in Judaica from Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, an MA in Jewish Literature from Northwestern University, and a master's degree in social work from the University of Minnesota. She was ordained as a rabbi by HUCJIR in spring 2012. It is now my great pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Rabbi Rachel Adler.
Well, good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are. This topic is a pretty complicated one. So I'd like to start with the gender definition, just so we all are talking about the same thing. So if we could go to that that document that I gave you, and let's read it together and make sure that we all understand, have the same understanding of gender to start out with. So, gender is a way of categorizing human beings. It's enacted through posture, body expression, such as walking, talking, gesturing, sports, football, soccer, baseball, tennis, gymnastics, and arts that depend on bodily activity like dancing or drama, through dress and adornment, through the use of language. Sexual orientation means the direction of one's sexual attractions. Now, there are two models for understanding gender that I'm giving you here. In an essentialist model, the essentialist model is prescriptive about sexual orientation, and a constructivist model is not. So let's scroll a little and look at what an essentialist model is. What you'll notice is you know about these models because there is a gender war taking place in American society based on these models. In the essentialist model, gender is binary. You've got two choices. You can be male or female. Sexual orientation should be toward the opposite gender. Gender categories are natural and instinctual. They're not cultural. They transcend gender and history. So what do I mean by that? I guess something along the lines of that as far back as you could go in history, the perception is that gender has always been the same. What it means to be a man or what it means to be a woman is always the same thing. Gender categories and gender appropriate behavior are not considered to change or evolve. They're permanent and they're inborn. And consequently, deviance from gender appropriate behavior or sexual orientation have got to be either sinful or mentally ill. Binary systems usually hierarchize their two components, and I give you three guesses which component of the sexual binary or the gender binary is on top. Now, the constructivist model. In a constructivist model, gender categories and sexual norms differ culturally and historically. Genders may have, or groups within them may develop, many more than two genders. People are socialized, usually, but not always successfully, into their assigned genders. We'll talk about this a little more in a minute, but you probably are aware that rabbinic gender divides into five or six genders rather than two. So norms and behaviors that are associated with gender may change as cultures change, and standards of gender appropriateness may change as well, because human beings are innovators and constructors in addition to being shaped by their socialization. And here's a point that's really crucial for us today, and that is because in this constructivist model, human beings construct gender categories and norms. Human beings are capable of ethically determining questions of gender justice. Indeed, it's constructivists who need a gender ethics. As a kind of corollary, I want to say there's no wiggling out of this one. If you believe that cultures evolve and that cultural behaviors are contextualized, that has to be as true for gender as it is for other cultural and historical facts. There's just no logical basis for making gender the exception to the rule. So, I want to go back to that point about gender appropriateness being a kind of moving target. A few years after I published The Jew Who Wasn't There, and then a couple more articles, there was a big conference about the woman problem versus Judaism. That was convened by the conservative movement. And at that session, the head of the pastoral psychiatry department at JTS gave a kind of generalized profile of the leaders of the Jewish feminist rebellion. That would be, among others, Judith Plaskow and me. He said that these women had particular kinds of pathologies, and that they tended to have sexual fantasies involving domination and whips and boots, which is not exactly how I've ever seen myself, but, you know. And that was a kind of gauge, one gauge, of how a kind of gender traditionalist perceived people who were changing the gender appropriateness standards. The other thing that I got called more than once was a transvestite, because I was wearing a tallit, I was for prayer, and tefillin. And I was teaching other women to put on tefillin. For a while there, I was sort of the anti-Chabad, you know, going out with my tefillin and to conferences and showing women how to do it. And that was perceived as very, very gender inappropriate. Now, if you asked almost anybody, I'm another cisgendered heterosexual woman, a little mouthy maybe, but nothing that's really, you know, glaringly gender inappropriate. It's not that I became more demure in the intervening years, it's that standards of gender appropriateness changed. So, one thing that the constructivist model has that the essentialist model doesn't have is factual support from sociology, anthropology, history. It does seem as if constructions of gender change. The other issue, I think we're done with this document now. All right, so the other issue that complicates matters, that we didn't used to have words for, is what is called intersectionality. Identities are complex. We all belong to a lot of different categories. There are differences among groups, and there are differences within groups. And it's all too easy for policymakers to be blind to those differences. The groundbreaking article on intersectionality was written by the scholar Kimberly Crenshaw, who was studying how race, ethnicity, and gender intersect to create new complications. If you are a woman, if you're transgender or intergender, if your sexual orientation is not heterosexual, you may be subject not only to oppression or discrimination on the basis of gender or sexual orientation, but to various intersecting oppressions, like racism, poverty, religious discrimination, disability, and ageism. And those oppressions are not layered and separate, like those multi-flavor popsicles that you can get. Instead, they percolate into one another, and they fashion many different kinds of distinctive and painful stresses. Try being a disabled, aging, Jewish, butch lesbian. And that's a set of intersecting discriminations you may be dealing with. You could be a trans Jew of color, and you could be a poor trans Jew of color, and look at how it is for you at your local synagogue. So you can't assume that there is a single identity that you have that is just a gender identity that isn't complicated by these other identities. And this kind of fits into a larger theme in modern Jewish thought, which is there's a critique of universalism that's been going on for a while. The problem with universalisms is that they focus on what makes everyone the same. They focus on what we all have in common, and that's a lovely thing to do. But it makes us blind to the things that make us different from one another that may burden us maybe the things that make us hurt. And ethically, we need to be attentive to those things. We as Jews have seen some very painful problems with forming coalitions. Everybody is anxious about not being seen. There was the problem of the big march for racial justice that occurred on Yom Kippur. There was a nice apology eventually from the organizers, and they did schedule other events to make tikkun. But think how that would be for you, how that was for you if you were a Jew of color. There was the debacle of the Women's March and the problems for women who identified as progressive Zionists. There are problems for Jews who are in some ways subject to an oppression, and in other ways very privileged. You can be both of those at the same time. And anti-Semitism doesn't feel any better if you're a rich Jew than it does if you're a poor Jew. It may, you know, it may provide you a certain amount of cushioning for a while, but as we saw from Nazi Germany, that can be pretty uncertain. In some ways, we discriminate against people who have oppressions that we may come to experience. My friend, Rabbi Elliot Dorf, is fond of saying that most people who are fully abled are fully abled temporarily. You start getting old, you may not be so abled. So, furthermore, everybody, if they're lucky, gets old. But ageism is, ageism kicks in this culture as soon as you hit 40. You may live to be 90 or 100, but ageism kicks in at age 40. Everybody dies, but dying people or people with potentially fatal diseases get stigmatized. A whole lot of people experience poverty who didn't expect to be poor. There are wages going down. There are layoffs. There are crippling student loans. There are inadequate pensions for old age. So we should really think twice before we other anybody, if we can't if we can't respect their otherness, at least we should remember that other could well be the future us. So, I want to talk now a bit about kinds of gender oppression. And nobody could cover all this in an hour. You couldn't cover it all in a semester. But I want to point to some issues that are big and are current. First of all, at the CCAR this week, there's been a big conversation and a group appointed to look into wage inequality. For a long time, we've known that women rabbis don't get paid by the same standard that male rabbis get paid by. That's a problem. There's a problem about how we understand leadership. And we have this very much out of our tradition. We come out of a tradition where women were not very visible. You go and check at the proportion of men's names recorded in the Bible and the proportion of women's names recorded in the Bible. I think it's about 4 to 1, maybe more. You think about the models of leadership that you have. I'm seeing this in my grandson, Michael, right now. My grandson, Michael, is 5 years old. So I got a video of Michael in the large all-purpose carton that assumes various roles in Michael and his sister Maya's imaginations. Michael's in the box and he's saying, "Here I am with all my toys floating down the Nile. Maya, you come and find me." There is another in which Michael says, "Here's a picture of me with my staff splitting the sea and leading the people out of Egypt." What is there for Maya to do? I volunteered to send Maya a tambourine so that she could be Miriam. I was really pushing this thing. Maya's parents vetoed the tambourine. And that's kind of understandable. A tambourine can make a heck of a lot of noise. But I'm still kind of worried about what models are there for Maya. We go to those rabbinic models, and there have been various things that that people have done with those rabbinic models. There was a while in early Jewish feminism where we kind of played, let's search the Talmud for the women. And every time we found one, it was this great moment. Oh, let's all hold hands. There's a woman in this sugya. Well, you know, then you have to really look at that material critically. Well, how is the woman functioning in the sugya? Let's remember that the woman didn't write the sugya. The woman is being represented in the sugya, and she's being represented by men. So what exactly did this mean to the men who were representing her? That that's a whole kind of more complicated way of reading those rabbinic texts. The gender activists who are looking for non-binary models of gender were very delighted to find the genders of Mishnah and Gemara. But one of the articles I put on the bibliography I gave you, which is a rather slapdash bibliography, but it's better than nothing, is an article by Professor Sarah Lave at RRC. And she points out that most of those genders are derived from Greek and Roman medical textbooks. Well, on the one hand, what that seems to say is the rabbis were saying, we're not going to construct gender for you. We're going to use the best information that we have on what the varieties of gender are. They're not doing this in a disinterested way. They have a couple of concerns. And if you read the article on this by Charlotta von Robert, which is also on your bibliography, you'll see. First of all, they're concerned about who can reproduce. You know, you're a small people, that's a concern. And the other concern is who has what obligations. Now, if you read another article I gave you on that bibliography, which is by a collection by a trans activist scholar named Noach Zamora, he points out that the important thing that he sees in those texts is that people who are trans or intersexual or in some way non-binary are not being left out of the community. There is a concern about including them in the community, and there's a concern about determining their obligations. In the ancient world, remember, your status didn't come from your rights. Rights were really not a concept until the Enlightenment. What determined your status was your obligations. If you were a slave, you didn't have obligations, really, or you had very few obligations because somebody else was determining your time use and your commitments. Same with women. So to say that these different varieties of gender had obligations, that's an important thing. The bad news about it is that all of the rabbinic categories can be arranged into a hierarchy, and the top of the hierarchy is the heterosexual male, and then the other categories get determined in reference to how much they resemble heterosexual males. There's the androgynos, the person who has characteristics of maleness and of femaleness. Well, they've got some maleness, so they have most of the obligations that males have. There is the tumtum, who is a safek male. In other words, since you can't determine what that person's genitalia are because they are concealed or internal, you have a 50% chance that they're male. And on the basis of that, they have certain obligations. The very bottom of the hierarchy is the woman, because there isn't any chance that she has any maleness about her. This is problematic. And there are, that's why there is a feminist legal critique. So, when we look at the text that we've got, and we think about what a leader is, what kind of mental picture do we have? Unfortunately, we're not alone in this. I just read an article about an exercise that organizational psychologists use called Draw a Leader. Interestingly, when people drew a leader, most of those leaders were male. If you think about that, and you think about the difficulties women have with leadership in many different fields, well, there's no question that the most fundamental problem is they're fighting a mental picture of a leader that doesn't include them. We're going to have to learn how to draw another picture. I want to come to the most painful part of this presentation. And I want to assure you again that the only visual that you're going to get about this is the rape culture document that I've given you. And Dina, if we can turn to that, that would be a good thing. I want to make this as safe as possible because some of you, if you're a woman, you're very likely to have experienced some level of the oppressions of a rape culture. Even if you are not a woman, you can experience those oppressions. There was an article in a recent issue of the Forward that you can find on theforward.com. It's called Their Enduring Nightmare. And it is about what happened to a group of campers who went on a teen tour, and a number of the male campers were molested by one of the leaders. And they're still awaiting an apology of some kind from USY 2 decades later. You may know that there was a famous case at YU of boys getting molested in the dormitories by a very respected rabbi. This was the YU high school. YU managed to evade this issue for so many years that it timed out in the New York courts. Those male students also never got an answer. In some ways, very young boys or men get feminized. They are viewed as less powerful, and they can be victimized with impunity. And that's pretty much what it's like to be a woman. So let's look at this rape culture pyramid. The reason I like this graphic is that it doesn't portray rape as something in itself, you know, a kind of unusual crime. It talks about it as the top of a continuum. In a rape culture, there are all kinds of behaviors that are normalized. And many of you will have experienced those behaviors yourselves. Boys will be boys. I remember when I was an adolescent on the playground, you know, seventh and eighth grade, where girls are just developing breasts. And the boys, you know, would run up and grab our breasts. And we complained to the teacher, and this is what we got told. Well, you know, boys are not as mature as girls at this stage. So you have to be understanding of them. Why do we have to be understanding? Why don't they get told that that's inappropriate behavior? Rape jokes, locker room banter. Oh, it was just locker room banter. A famous political figure who was indiscreet enough to put some of his behavior on tape, explained it away as locker room banter. All kinds of unwanted touch are kind of microaggressions. If you study sociology on this issue of touch, you find that it's very much associated with dominance, who touches who, whom, pardon me. Catcalling, flashing or exposing. The internet has made possible a whole new range of microaggressions that can be done to women. Then you have victim blaming. Oh, you got raped? What were you wearing? There was just a case just within the last month or two where the defendant, a fine young man from Yale, got acquitted of rape on precisely those grounds. The defense focused on why the Halloween costume that the victim wore was a pussycat outfit rather than a long flowing Cinderella dress. Stalking or following. And these are They're categorizing these as kind of moving upward in the realm of degradation, groping, safe word violations, coercion, revenge porn, stealthing, which is kind of a new thing. And finally, you know, up at the top there, molestation and drugging. That means like date rape, drugs, and rape. Those are categorized as assault. These other things down here are micro assaults or normalized assaults. I have to say that I don't think we get yet a lot of help from our tradition on this. I would point to some feminist writers, notably Ronit Irshai in Israel, who are writing on critiquing rape in our texts. Also, I point you toward the article that Rabbi Gavi Root has written on the rape of Dina and the culture of rape, which is now is going to become a book. She is going to have a book out within the next, I think, year to 18 months on this issue. And she does something very interesting. She takes the commentaries on the rape of Dina in Vayishlach, I think it's Genesis 34, and I think we could get rid of that rape culture graphic now. And what she does is to trace it through all of the commentaries. And she asks, what did people write about this? And what she finds is that in the intertestamental period, the texts are very sympathetic toward Dina. When Judith prays before she goes and seduces and assassinates the Greek general Holofernes, she cites Dina in her prayer. It's the rabbis, particularly in the Midrash, who become very anti-Dina. They blame Dina for what happened to her. And she takes it all the way into the modern period, and she shows a kind of resurgence of the most negative commentaries, because the medievals played down some of the most anti-woman, you know, victim-blaming material on Dina. And in the modern period, you look at your stone chumash, and it's all of the most misogynistic woman-blaming stuff. So, we've got this stuff in our tradition. We don't have much that punishes the rape of non-virgins. You look if you want to see something that really requires vigorous critique at the third perek of Ketubot. There's work to do. There's work to do about all of the aggressions, sexualized aggressions, because we're still seeing them in our community. If you look at hashtag Gamani, you'll see a huge outpouring of research about the omnipresence of rape culture behavior that donors direct toward female fundraisers in the Jewish community. If you look at hashtag MeToo on, for example, the Women's Rabbinic Network listserv, you find that an inordinate number of female rabbis deal with inappropriate behavior, microaggressions, or downright grabbing or kissing on the mouth by congregants. People have talked about some of the seamy undersides of behavior at HUC. There is a history. I think now we have some leaders in place who are pretty attentive to that. We're becoming pretty attentive to that. We have Rabbi Dr. Dvorah Weisberg at HUC LA, who is a tigress. I don't think that anybody here is going to dare to do these things to female rabbinical students today. But I got hit on. Not as a rabbinical student, but as a doctoral student here. Many women are telling those stories. They can't just get pushed under the rug. One in every four women in America will get raped during her lifetime. That's not funny. It rules our lives in a whole lot of ways. It rules how we're going to behave when we are walking to our car after a meeting. It rules how we're going to behave when if we want to have a conference with somebody. Do we close the office door? How do we behave with our superiors? Say a donor, wants to sit next to you and start grabbing your knee. And you go to your senior rabbi, and the senior rabbi says, well, please find some tactful way to cope. Where does that leave you? Rabbi Paul Kipnis just posted something that I was very heartened to read on the CCAR listserv saying, I just learned things about women rabbis that I didn't know. And I have to start asking questions to learn more. And I have to listen. If you've always been in a dominant position, if you've always had privilege, sometimes just being equal feels like a form of oppression. And I understand that. But the people who are in that position need to work with it. I want to leave this time open for people to comment or question or whatever you need to do.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for leading us in this very intense but sadly necessary conversation. I feel blessed that you were able to join us today and that you're able to share your insight and wisdom. We want to open this up now. We have a few minutes before the close of this session. If anybody has a question or if anybody has a thought to share, I'll start us off. I think one of the questions that I have is, and it's kind of a big question, I think one of the questions that I have is, where do we go from here? Many of us work with learners of all different ages, and I use the term learner liberally, to be anybody with whom we come in contact, essentially. Where can we go from here? What can we do to help in our own way of changing this culture?
Telling the truth is a good start. The other thing that I want to say about text, because this is my experience of those texts. I love Jewish texts. The text for us is a thou. The text is not an object. The text is a chavruta. So if you ever have been in a chavruta relationship, you don't ever tell your chavruta, everything you say is 100% right. This is just great. No, you probably challenge your chavruta. You get into all kinds of discussions with your chavruta, but you, unless it's been really extraordinarily awful, you don't fire your chavruta. You work it out. I don't think of the tradition as something that's a kind of reified object that I am looking at. My critique of the tradition becomes part of the tradition if it's a good enough critique. That's always been true. And it's true now for people who are on the downside of the binary, or people who are non-binary, who are talking their way into this tradition. They have things to teach all of us, and those things are also Torah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It is now the end of the session. If you have any further questions for Rabbi Rachel Adler, please, you may email me, alumni@huc.edu, and I will be happy to share that with you. And with that, I want to say, Rachel, thank you again for joining us. To our alumni, thank you for taking the time to be with us and learn with us. Again, visit a2c.edu/alumni-learn to see the other sessions and mini courses that we have this semester, as well as you can review videos from our past. We are now in our seventh semester. All of our videos are up online for the username and password. Please send me an email and I will be happy to share that. With that, I want to say thank you so very much. Have a wonderful day. And Rabbi Adler, there was actually a comment from, and this is post-recording, but yeah, okay. There was a-